I'm wearing two hats. You can't see any hats, but inside I'm wearing two hats. One hat is the chair of this session, which I'm delighted to be chairing. And the second is as the first presenter of the session, because this is me here, Stephen Ball. First of all, can I just begin by linking in with the previous session, which was fantastic. I hope those people who were in the previous session really appreciated that. I'm really pleased to have Mike and Will presenting today. And there are lots of connections between the previous presentation and this presentation. And you'll see some common words cropping up in my presentation. And I'm sure you'll hear similar things in my colleagues, Dr. Peter Spencer, who'll be speaking after me, and finally Dave Wickett, who'll be appearing last this morning. What we're going to do is, first of all, I'm going to be talking about how to become a professor, and that'll be for about 40 minutes. And then secondly, Peter's going to talk to you about how to become an expert at anything, which I'm really looking forward to hearing, to hear what he's got to say about that. And many of you will remember Peter from when he was an academic here in the university and from other associations. He may have even taught some of you. So we're delighted to have Peter return today to talk to you this morning. And then finally, Dave Wickett will be coming a little bit later on to present on a different kind of fat cat. And David will introduce himself to you and give you his background. But for those of you who don't know, David used to be a lecturer here in Sheffield Hallam University when it was called Sheffield Polytechnic for 20 years. He worked in the business school. He left and he set up a number of businesses both in Sheffield and in the States, which Dave, I'm sure, will go into detail about. And one of them is called the Fat Cat, which if you've been on your travels as a student doing public house tours, no doubt you'll have been there. So hence the reason why David is talking about a different kind of fat cat. And that will take place at about 11:05. Okay, so I'm going to be probably walking about a little bit because I tend to do that. Those people that know me from entrepreneurship know that I walk up and down, so you'll know that I do that quite a lot. So bear with me if I do that. And if you can't see anything and I'm standing in front of the screen, do tell me and I'll jump out of the way. A question for you, first of all. I've got my other hat on now, the second hat. I'm moving into my presentation for the next 40 minutes. To start with, a question. And the question is this. How many of you would like to be a professor? Please raise your hand. Okay, so we've got three or four. There's a few. There's a few down here somewhere. There's a few. Well, shall I put my hand up? Sean, to put my hand up? That's great. Well, hopefully you'll get a few thoughts and ideas from my presentation this morning. And I hope from what I'm going to say to all of you, there'll be a lot of interest in what I've got to say this morning. And there's a health warning this morning. And I must apologise in advance because there are a few visual images which may upset one or two of you in advance. I'll say no more. If you feel when they come up you must rush out of the room, then I fully understand. This is me, and these are some of the qualifications I've got. And this is a Doctorate of Education, Master of Philosophy, BSc Honours, Certificate of Education, Fellow of the Institute of Hospitality, which I know some of my colleagues here are also fellows, a Fellow of the Higher Education Academy, and an Honorary Fellow of CHEME, which is the Council for Hospitality Management Education. And I'll probably touch upon some of those again in a moment. This might have looked like me 20 years ago. Maybe when you see some of the visual images which you might find upsetting in a while, you'll think, yes, it does look like that. Hopefully I'm not as chaotic as that, but we'll see. What this presentation is about is, for those of you who are into research, I'm going to take an approach which has a mix of life history, self-analysis, and it's a longitudinal study. So there's all those kind of approaches coming together in this presentation. And naturally, I'll be talking very much about me. I apologise for that, but obviously That's the nature of the presentation. And one of the reasons why I'm talking about me and how I, if you like, have risen to the top is because over the last year or so, a number of my colleagues have approached me and said, Steve, how did you get to be a professor? What do you have to do? And I thought to myself, having had a number of people say that to me, maybe the best way to answer that is to present to all of you so I can share my experiences with all of you all in one go. And so perhaps we can have a discussion about it later on. So my agenda, interesting to see, I've used the same word as Mike and Will did in their presentation, the agenda. The first one is setting the scene. That will be the first aspect of the talk. The second one, the thought never crossed my mind period. In other words, the thought never crossed my mind that I would be a professor, would want to be a professor. In other words, that's associated with laying the hospitality management foundations in the 1972 to 1982 for me. Third area is laying the foundations for professorship. So in this section, I'll be talking about the hospitality management element. And in this element, I'll be talking about the professorship element, given that my talk's about becoming a professor of hospitality management, two separate parts to it. And the eureka moment when I suddenly woke up and thought, maybe I could be a professor. I want to talk a little bit about that. And then finally, the award and the aftermath. So that's the agenda, and I'll go through each of these in turn. Setting the scene. So what I want to do is just to talk to you, provide you a little bit of information about professors in the UK. And I apologise on these first few slides because there are quite a lot of words, but I'll leave the slide on so you can read them if you'd like to read them as we go through. But I shall talk over them. And as you can see from this particular slide, if we look at professors generally in the UK, there's been a rise in the number caused by the... Does anybody know what that stands for? None of my colleagues. Because if you don't know... anybody know what that means? That stands for the research assessment exercise, which is a bit of in-house jargon related to assessing the quality of research which academics are involved with in universities. So the RAE, growing competition in the sector, which I'm sure many of you are aware of in universities for students, for business, for research contracts, and so on, and the nature of institutional missions has led to an increase in the number of professors. And I know, I've heard it on the grapevine, that this institution is also seeking more professors. So those people who are interested, bear that in mind. Standards have risen dramatically, according to Ron Barnett, who's a well-known writer, which I know Peter has read, and I read when I did my doctorate. And what it is to be a professor and what it takes to become one has changed significantly. Interestingly, 76% of UK national staff in over 16,000 professorial roles, 16,000 professors in the UK, are white males. That's very interesting, and I'll show you something else related to that in a moment. That's according to a very latest report from the Equality in Higher Education Statistical Report. And in my view, in the UK, a professorship remains something to which to aspire to. It's something you can be proud of. It's something to which I feel I've risen to the top towards, and I hope that it will happen to you in due course. I think there's a lot of words here, so just take your time reading it. But what is a professor and what do they do? It's a very confused picture, according to this leader from the Times Higher Education, which also contained the handout which you've all had, which was a little bit of amusement about professors, written by Laurie Taylor, if any of you read the Times Higher, related to professors. But this is a bit more serious, and this was based upon a report. What it means to be a professor, and more importantly, what others think it means, is magnificently opaque. There's plenty of advice on how to get there, but I'm not actually sure there is plenty of advice on how to get there. But little once you've reached your destination. There's no global job description, no template, no handbook, only the examples of those who have gone before, like me, hence the reason I'm standing before you today. There's no consensus. Definitions vary by country, institution, and mission. And it's unclear whether professors are there to improve research or teaching. So I think that's quite an interesting scenario behind the scene. Interestingly, this area of professors has become the subject of a considerable amount of contemporary research. These are some which I'm aware of. This was actually my own work back in 8 years ago for my Doctorate of Education, which wasn't about professors as such, but it related to professors because it related to leadership. These others are excellent pieces of work, and for those who are interested, this last one's just come out this month on intellectual leadership in higher education, and it's about the roles of professors, which you may find interesting, written by a guy from Hong Kong Polytechnic. Another little funny here, which maybe at first you don't see, but how do professors spend their time? This is from a comic cartoon. This is how they actually spend their time. You can read that for yourself. Teaching, research and service, which I'll go into in a bit more detail in a moment. How departments expect them to spend their time. According to this comic, they expect them to be researching 175% of the time, teaching 20% of the time, and this service thing is something they do outside of the organisation in their own time. And this is interesting, the view of professors, how professors would like to spend their time. Don't tell me what to do. I hope I've never been like that all the time that I've been here. The role of professors then, well, it seems to me it's about advancing and disseminating or professing, that's where the word comes from, professing knowledge. And professors are the major authorities in their subjects. So I like to feel, but my colleagues are probably telling differently, that I'm an authority on hospitality management, the subject of hospitality management, which goes a little bit further than that, as I'll tell you in a moment. And to profess, what professors do is they conduct research, which is all this stuff here, write papers, write books, which I'll talk about more so later on. They teach students, deliver courses, deal with assessments, as some of my students will know, supervise dissertations, advise students generally. So we do all of that. But also, perhaps where there's slightly something different to other academics, because in many ways other academics do this, they should be doing this, is that professors are involved with this area here. Again, which some of my colleagues are also involved with, but probably professors more so. So they're involved in university administration and politics, obtaining funds and grants, commercial research, consultancy work, leading and inspiring others, sitting on outside bodies, and so on. A whole range of things, and there's probably far more that we do than just that. This one was quite interesting, putting it together. These are, from my perspective, these are the current professors who work in the hospitality subject area. And some of these names should be familiar to you. Andrew Lockwood, Forte Professor of Management at University of Surrey. Professor Peter Jones, again from the University of Surrey. Professor Conrad Lashley, who's now working at Oxford Brookshire University, point two, I think Conrad works there. David Foskett, we were talking about last night with Vic, is at the University of West London. And another Peter Jones, who was previously the project director of a very exciting project at the Edge Hotel School, which some of you may be familiar with. If you're not, it's interesting to look at as a model for delivering hospitality management education. Put me on the list as well, I guess. So, what's the commonness there? All male.
All good-looking.
All white. All good-looking, yes, correct, Peter. All, and you don't probably want to be honest, but all actually post 55, 56, 57. We're ageing, we're white, we're good-looking, we're male. There's some names you might think are missing off that list. And I thought a lot about this, and I've done a little bit of research into this myself. There's one of our visiting fellows who's unfortunately not here today. He's busy doing an external validation, Keith Johnson. Keith was professor until January when he retired from Leeds Metropolitan University. He is he's no longer a professor. He's not allowed to use the title anymore. Another one that somebody pointed out is a guy called Dolph Morgendorf. Dolph, as far as I'm aware, is no longer a professor, doesn't use that title. I was trying to think of women who are professors. The only one I'm aware of who might sit in this grouping is Alison Morrison, which some of you will know. Alison Morrison has been a professor in the UK for a long time. She departed to work as a dean, I think it is, in Melbourne in Australia. So she's not actually in the UK anymore. Otherwise, she would have been on that list. Forgive me if I've missed anybody else off that list, but I couldn't think of anybody anymore. So there aren't very many of us. We're a kind of a small band of professors. So again, opportunities for guys who, like yourselves, who want to become a professor. I know all of these people on first name terms. I know all the ones I mentioned on first name terms. They know me, and it's all about that networking, which Will talked about earlier on. I can ring any of these up, call them Andy, and we'll have a conversation about whatever it is. I've worked with them on many occasions. So the importance of relationships, of getting to know people, building those relationships over many years is vital to rising to the top. Here's one of the pictures you might want to cover your eyes up. I suppose, broadly speaking, the anatomy of a professor, of all those people, is like that. We're all, you're all human beings. We're not aliens at all. You can talk to us. We're easily people that you can communicate with very easily. But we've got fire in the belly. We've got other things, I guess, as well. But we've got plenty of fire. We've got passion. I mean, I've always been passionate about hospitality management. I still am. And I'm very passionate and have always been about hospitality management education, as you'll see in a moment. And obviously, knowledge is also important. But I'll break that down a little bit further as we progress. So that's setting the scene. So let's go back in my life to this particular period here, 1972 to 1982. This is where I call it the thought never crossed my mind. I never, ever thought I'd be standing here in front of you talking about being a professor. At that time, I was, I was born in 54, so I was 18. Yeah, that's right, isn't it? Yeah, 16, 18. So I was 18. Not much different to some of you in the audience today. But what I was doing there was I was laying the foundations for hospitality management. Now, here's one which people will cringe at. I dug around in my photograph album trying to find suitable photographs. And it's funny, isn't it, that I couldn't find anything related to work in those early years which related to hospitality management or related to work at all. I've got lots of pictures of me at parties. I've got lots of pictures of me with family and friends on holidays, but nothing related to work. This is the only one that I found. And it's a little bit hospitality related. And you perhaps think, what the hell is he doing there? I wondered what I was doing there. Anybody like to take a guess? No? This. Of digging, that's right. I used to work at this company here, Davenport's Brewery. And Davenport's Brewery doesn't exist anymore. And it was taken over by a brewery in Nottingham. Forget what the name of it was now. But when I was a student of your age, in the summer, to get money, I worked in Davenport's Brewery. And one of the jobs I had in Davenport's Brewery was to clean out the mash tuns. And to clean out the mash tuns, it's something like 100 degrees Fahrenheit or more. It's really, really hot. And what you had to do was to strip off, put some shorts on, wellies, get in there. The grains were this high. You were down in a hole in a big tank and scoop out the grains. Davenport's had public houses, they had off licences, they had a brewery, and I was involved in all sorts of activities then. But also, I did lots of other things within the industry related to hospitality management. I worked for Bass Taverns, which some of you all know, and since that time I've done considerable amount of consultancy work and management development work with Bass Taverns. I worked with another company which doesn't exist anymore, MVC Hotels. And where did I work there? One of the top hotels at the time, which Peter will know because he worked there too, the Piccadilly Hotel in Manchester. In that period, I also did lots of other kinds of work. My first job was 45 years ago when I started in the greengrocers, and I don't know whether I earned less than what Will earned or Mike when they gave their story, but it wasn't very much. And I've been working for 45 years in all sorts of occupations. But at that time, that's where the hospitality management list came out. Another interesting one. That was when I graduated in 1977. And my first degree was in geography. That was my first degree, my first dissertation. Since that time, I've done four dissertations. So I think I know a little bit about dissertations. The first dissertation, if you're interested to know, was about aircraft pollution at Birmingham Airport. So it's interesting what you go on to pursue, isn't it? Following that degree, I then went on to do an advanced postgraduate advanced diploma in hotel and catering administration at Hollings College in Manchester, which is now Manchester Metropolitan University. And it's very interesting talking to colleagues like Ian at the front here and Peter, who also went to Hollings College. And there are a number of other fellows also who are not with us today, sadly, who went to Hollings College. It's a really cracking place to go to in those years. And on leaving there, having graduated, having done a second dissertation, I went into the health service, the National Health Service, which is very topical at the moment, related to catering, if you're keeping up with the press. And this was me as an assistant catering manager at the London Hospital at Whitechapel, which is one of the leading hospitals medically within the UK, and is one of the leading teaching hospitals. And the first day I started with somebody you may have read about, a guy called Tim West, who's a very long-standing friend, some of you will know. And Tim went on to become Managing Director of High Table, Managing Director of Elior UK, and he's now the co-owner of Lexington Catering. And he's still a very close friend of mine after all those years. That was 1977. This was my boss at the time. I was in charge of staff catering big responsibility. I was responsible for 60 staff, and the overall staffing complement was well over 100 in the catering department. I stayed there for 18 months, became deputy catering manager. And then I left there and went to Barking Hospital, which some of you may know, Barking in East London, where I was a catering manager. This is a difficult one to pick out, but that's me there. These were some of my staff. I haven't still got that tie, by the way, guys. I know some of you might say, I'm sure we've seen that tie and that jacket. I stayed there for 2.5 years and loved it. I could have stayed there forever. I used to go in the morning, sit down at the desk, and staff used to bring me my breakfast, my coffee, my lunch. Fantastic job. I was 27, and I thought, I've got another 40-odd years, 50 years to go yet, work. I can't do this. I've got some fire in the belly. We talked about fire in the belly. I want to achieve. And I thought, what shall I do? And I applied for jobs in catering, to be a manager, to go further up the ladder. I felt at that time the opportunities in the health service were not too many beyond being catering managers. There's not a very high promotion ladder within the National Health Service for caterers. So eventually I left and went to the next stage of my life, 1982 to 2006, laying the foundations for a professorship. And I went to what was then called Huddersfield Polytechnic, now called the University of Huddersfield. I was extremely lucky. However, I have to say, I think I chose extremely well, because selection to me is a two-way process. It's not just about the employers choosing you, it's you choosing the employer and the organisation. At that time, and I think this is more or less indisputable, and I'm sure some of my senior colleagues amongst us would probably agree with this, that Huddersfield was one of the leading hospitality management teaching and research centres in the UK, and possibly even in the world. There were people who have went on to become Professor David Littlejohn, visiting Professor Paul Slattery, who colleagues will know, Professor Keith Johnson, who I mentioned, Professor Ray Pine, really, really top people in our field. And there was just a clutch of them all in the same organisation. And you can imagine the dynamism that there was working in that environment. We really moved mountains. It was sad when it broke up, but that happens wherever you go in life. Things move on. I suppose for me there, a key milestone on this road towards becoming a professor was obtaining an MPhil, Master of Philosophy. And my MPhil in 1993, I know we were kind of laughing about this last night when we were out with some of our visitors, was about fast food. You probably didn't know this, but at that time I was one of the leading authorities on the fast food industry and the fast food systems in the UK. And I did a case study of Wimpy International. And that's still available in the library if you're interested. recommended. A good read. Also, when I was at Huddersfield, this is just a flavour of some of the responsibilities. When I came to leave there in 1998, at that time, these were all the roles that I had. These won't mean much to most of you, but I can tell you it was damned hard work fulfilling all these responsibilities. And some of these roles people perhaps be aware of, my academic colleagues. That was before I came here in 1998. Pathways leader, I'd been admissions tutor, year tutor, senior course tutor. I sat on all these committees. I was head of the research centre. That's what it takes. Then the eureka moment came. And I guess part of that was coming here to Sheffield Hallam University. And what I did was, this is probably a little bit squashed, or maybe it isn't looking at itself in the mirror this morning. It's a bit like one of those looking in those mirrors, isn't it? When I first came here, four of us, Peter Spencer, don't know where he's gone, Peter, Susan Horner and Kevin Neild, who's our head of department now, as most of you all know, we all started a doctorate in education at the same time. We all completed on time. No messages here to anybody sitting in this audience. We all did it without the university giving us any extra time to do it. And we were very proud of that, and it was a proud moment when we all went on the stage to receive our degree certificate and our award. And I think it was really about then, 2004, where I started to think, hang on a minute, maybe there's something about this professor thing. Maybe I'm not as far away as I thought I was. And in 2002, just a couple of years before that, the university runs lots of training and development sessions, and one was on professorial applications. I looked through my records, and I saw that I'd actually gone on that in 2002. It was beginning to sit in the back of my mind. And for those people, those colleagues are interested, I recommend you go to that. I then commenced drafting the application in June 2005. It took me that long to get it together, guys. So if you think, you spent a few days putting an application form, it took me 6 months to get it together. I've got it here, 18 sides long, plus a CV, which, most academic CVs are very long as well. 18 sides, all supported with hard evidence. It wasn't waffle, it was hard evidence. And I had our past dean review it for me, and also the head of research in the university reviewed it before I submitted it, so that I could get their inputs to get it as right as I could do. Submitted it, and I was awarded the title of, which I asked for, you're asked, what would you like to be? Because this was a personal chair. And I said I would like to be, if it's awarded successfully, Professor of Hospitality Management, which was what I was passionate about. That application, I had to have four referees, and I was also asked to identify four independent assessors of a high status also to look at my application. Unfortunately, because I knew all these people who were already professors, it was easy peasy, no problem at all. And they were involved in reviewing my application. There was no interview. It was just done on submitting an application form. I had to wait from October to March before I found out whether I'd been successful or not. So it's a long time waiting. So if sometimes you think you don't hear from an application you might make, just think how long, you know, you might have to wait in certain situations. But it was quite an anxious time. At the time I made that particular application, I had some key leadership roles as well here in Sheffield, Hallam and externally. I was then the director of the Centre for International Hospitality Management Research, member of the University Research Degrees Committee, and I was a reader in hospitality management, which is another curious academic role, which another time perhaps I can talk to you about. And also, this was a very interesting role, which I could spend all day talking to you about, but sadly I haven't got time today. But importantly, also, I had a lot of external leadership positions, some of these which continue today, and you can read those for yourself. So you can see one of the themes that's coming out in terms of rising to the top for me is leadership. So this is me thinking, what did I need to become a professor? Intellectual leadership and other leadership qualities. Hardworking and determined. You have to be independent. You have to demonstrate yourself as a worthy individual. But for me, as hopefully my colleagues know and all everybody else here knows, it's about being a team player. It's about working together. It's about being collective as well. And many of the publications and presentations that I've given, I've done on a team basis. Not only because it's improved the presentation, but it's helped me and the other presenter in terms of developing their profile. Inner focus of control. You have to be really controlled internally. Passionate, again, a common word that Will mentioned. Committed, dedicated. You've always got to go the extra mile. And again, Will talked about it. If your boss requires you to stay on later, you do it. If a piece of work requires you putting in the extra time, you do it. If you've got a deadline to meet, you make sure you meet that deadline. If you don't, then you're not going to achieve. You've got to be decisive. No pussyfooting about. Very often, you have to make difficult decisions. They have to be decisions which maybe some people don't agree with, but you have to be decisive. And from my perspective, maybe to my detriment at times, I've had a tendency to always say yes. So if somebody rang me up and said, Steve, any chance of doing this piece of work for me? Any chance of writing this book chapter? Any chance of presenting at this conference? Any chance of leading this group? More often than not, I've said yes. And at times it's been tough, but I've gained so much from doing that. I'm learning to say no, actually, now. Too late. There's a need to achieve. You know, that is really important. And I've always felt the process, yes, the process is important. We know that. But this is the most important thing. And anybody who comes from the industry will tell you it's about results, it's about performance, and it's about outputs. We can all sit and talk, and we love talking, don't we, and pontificating, but this is what it's about. And I've never, ever forgotten that. You've got to be self-confident, you've got to be self-motivated very often, because there's nobody there to push you. You've got to drive yourself to all times of the week, all times of the day, and all times of the year, and in successive years. In January, just gone, I've just celebrated, if that's the right word, 30 years as an academic in hospitality management education. It's a long time to keep yourself going for 30 years. Every year, every day, takes a lot of drive, takes a lot of motivation, and you've got to be very confident in what you do. This is for the benefit of those students I teach entrepreneurship. It isn't really, because I think I am an entrepreneurial in what I've done, and I could spend a lot of time talking to you about entrepreneurial things that I've done. For example, when I was in the health service, I was one of the pioneers of the introduction of the Cook-Chill system at the London Hospital. Here at Hallam, I was the founder, along with one or two other colleagues here, Peter, for example, of Eat Sheffield, which is now everybody talks about it. You know, I was at the forefront of that. And there are lots of other things which are entrepreneurial, where I saw the opportunities with colleagues and we moved forward on that. Where have I got the buzz from? Well, I can tell you as a professor, it's not from money. I wish it was. Interestingly, I get nothing as a professor. I don't get paid as a professor in the university. I get paid as a principal lecturer. So that's interesting for you. Different to other universities. What do I get out of it? I get the satisfaction out of the results, out of knowing that I've achieved, and you know, and also the pleasure of teaching you and working with all of you here. Just a little bit about the application process. I'll move on quickly. It's changed over the years, but you have a set of criteria to which you have to relate your application to. This was the first one, national international contribution by scholarship research and consultancy. That was the first criteria that I applied against. The second one, leadership relevant to the vision, values and strategic objectives of Sheffield Hallam University. The third one, contribution to the aims and or wider development of the education sector. So, but there are other criteria which didn't fit my particular case, which you may be interested in to look at some point. So then we come on to the last part of my agenda, the award and the aftermath. What am I doing now, more recently? Here's an example 2 or 3 years ago now, where I was the chair of the International Scientific Committee, which is a research committee, for a conference which was held in South Africa. That's me. I've changed a little bit, just in case you didn't know. This, some of you should know, is Joseph Mensah. Answer. You might know Joseph, who just recently got his doctorate from Sheffield Hallam University, and he's gone back to Ghana to teach in an academic institution. And these other guys are academics and local people from this particular visit. Another activity I was involved with, I was a member of a professorial promotion special committee in Cyprus. This wasn't where the panel actually did the work, by the way. I have to tell you guys. This was after the panel. Sandra Watson, some of you might know. HR people might have heard of Sandra Watson. Clayton Barrows, I saw on Bill's desk yesterday. Where's Bill? Clayton Barrows' book, Hospitality Management, American. John Beach, another American. And this was the head of department in Cyprus. I'm doing lots of things like that. But crucially, to be a professor for me, I hung my case on this, was research and writing, publishing. To be a professor, to get anywhere being a professor, as I keep telling people, no names mentioned, it's about publishing. This counted up all through my CV. This is what I've done to date. 15 book reports, conference proceedings, 16 book chapters, 63 published journal articles and conference papers, 32 unpublished public works, including keynote presentations. Plus, I should think, thousands of lectures to students, seminars, workshops, plus distance learning materials, which I haven't counted, which we sometimes talk about, etc., etc. And those are some of the books. Get along to your bookshop and buy them now. You can buy this, because I bought an extra copy on eBay for a penny. A penny now. Is that good? Is that good? Is that good? So in summary, we talked about having an end point. In summary, these are the building blocks for me of being a professorship. You can read those for yourself. Leadership, behaviour, personality characteristics. And it's about knowledge, it's about skills, it's being able to present at presentations like this, it's being able to have a thick skin when people laugh at you, etc., etc. Being a professor, though, is a journey. It's not a destination in itself. It doesn't stop. When you are awarded professor, like most other things, it doesn't stop at that point. You carry on. You carry on into the future. It's an ongoing journey. And finally, I just want to read you this little poem. This is from the late James J. Metcalfe, who some of you may have heard of. Very good poet, actually, American poet. And this is entitled Professors. Professors are respected souls, albeit underpaid, or in my case, not paid. And not infrequently they are quite dignified and staid. Well, you tell me if that's true. Their learning is attested by 2 or 3 degrees, from highly rated colleges or universities. They lecture by the hour and they carefully explain the theories and facts there are to fill the student's brain. And in return, they only ask obedience and truth as part of their campaign to build the character of youth. Professors are the persons who are plain and undisguised, but whose superb abilities are seldom recognised. Thank you very much. And Dave's been, as I mentioned earlier on, associated with the university for very many years, and it's superb that he's come along to talk to you today to talk about how he's risen to the top and some of the experiences he's had. So without further ado, I hand the stage to Dave for about 40 minutes, 35, 40 minutes or so. Yeah. Maybe there's time for questions, we'll see. Yeah.
Hi, well, you have to excuse me because I've got very bad cancer at the moment and I know I haven't got long to go. But anyway, the thing is, I joined this place, Polytechnic it used to be called, in 1970, and I find it rather ironic that I'm back on the floor that made my life, because it was onto this floor that we did certain things in 1975. I put a bar in here. We had half this floor was a staff bar. My God, we did used to drink in those days. It's rather strange that we finish up back on this floor.
No bar
now. I think we went through a number of principals that were very against drinking. Perhaps the irony was, in those days, the guy that did always come up for a drink was the principal who was the Reverend Dr. George Tolley. So, he was quite happy to pop up for a pint two or three times a week. But anyway, yeah, I joined the Polytechnic as a lecturer in economics in about 1970. And one of the things that was happening in the early 70s that I got very interested in was something called real ale. We suddenly started to read what it meant, because I didn't know. I just went into a pub and bought a pint of beer. Didn't mean anything to me what it was. Lager, bitter, keg, not keg. I didn't know, didn't care. But I read about it, and I got absolutely fascinated by this. As I said, the first opportunity I had to do anything was when the then principal offered us half this floor. Half this floor was the library. The library was on the move. It was vacating. The whole library was half of this floor. Yeah, it had moved up. When I joined, the library was the little room on the fifth floor. As you go up the first flight of stairs on your right, it shows you how the place has grown. Anyway, I put in this bar, and the thing I wanted more than anything was some hand pumps, hand pump beer. That was my love, and I thought, that's where I can spend my lunch times and beyond. And we put in a dance floor, we put in a full-size snooker table, and it was extremely successful. But of course, I wasn't paid. It was an honorary post. I was the chairman. But I got a lot of fun out of it. And the one thing that I realized, I started to lecture on the subject, and I set up a Sheffield Hallam Brewery research team. We published quite a lot of papers, and we certainly did a lot of influential work with the government, who at that time were looking to change the rules. And I remember going down to Westminster on a number of occasions to talk to various ministers on what was wrong with the industry. So I think we had a tiny bit of influence, but it was a very useful time. But anyway, what was much more important to me was that I saw that there was an enormous gap in the market. It was nice having this bar, but what about outside? Well, Sheffield, I discovered, had 640 pubs. Every single one of them was owned by a brewery. There was not one free house. So I decided to look around. These were very difficult to come by. Breweries hardly ever sold pubs because they got a very high monopoly value. Anyway, in 1980, one tatty old pub in a side road of an awful area of Sheffield called Culham Island, it was called the Alma, did become available. And I decided to go to the bank, try and borrow some money, which I managed, and go off to an auction. Scared the life out of me because I'd nowhere near enough money. I mean, you didn't get paid much as a lecturer, and I had expected to buy this thing for about 20,000. It went up to 34,700. I hadn't got that money, but I just kept sticking my hand up in case. And at the end of the day, I'd got it. And I went home that night terrified, thinking, what do I do now? Well, I'd got a friend I played football with. He lent me some money, and I went to the bank, and they agreed to lend me a bit more. And one way or another, we managed to scrape it together. And it really was a scrape it together. But anyway, I remember going out that night to celebrate with three or four friends and my wife. And somebody said to me in that party, have you thought what you're going to call it? And I said, oh, I'm giving it first idea. I've been just involved in getting it, first of all. And I remember my wife stood next to me, said, I've always fancied a pub called the Fat Cat. I said, what a great name. And with that, she took a beer mat, you know, the way that you can get a beer mat and sort of pull it in half so you've got clean surfaces. She sketched the outline of a fat cat. And we filled that in the next day, and that's been our logo ever since that day back in 1980. Everyone told me what I was doing was totally mad. I was bringing in 8 beers at that time, and I insisted that none of the beers should be available in Sheffield. So we brought in some pretty strange sounding beers to them at the time, things called London Pride, Boddington's, beers that you know, you'd think were strange, but they weren't, they were just beautiful. And I decided, because you see, I used to play a lot of football, and when I used to go out with my mates afterwards, none of us were smokers. So I wanted most of the pub to be no smoking. Well, that was, everyone said, that's totally crazy to do that. I mean, nobody, they said, nobody goes out for a drink and doesn't smoke. And I said, well, it's funny, because we don't when we play football. So I made half of it no smoking, ripped out all the fruit machines, ripped out, I said, no fruit machines, no music. It's got to be perfectly silent. It's got to look like a Victorian pub. I just want people to come in and drink and talk. And, well, it's not done bad. We had our 30th birthday this year. And, you know, we've got a few stars as customers, but it's a fabulous place, and it's busier than ever. But anyway, so that was that. And I carried on here for a while. And one of the things that I was asked to look into was business studies, which is my department, their placement unit. And I took that over and looked at all the students getting jobs. And that took me by a very pleasant chance to a university in upstate New York, which had started work doing an exchange program with Sheffield. And this university agreed that they wanted to carry the program on. So I flew out to Rochester, and we set up a program. The program worked very well. We exchanged 1 student, 2 students, 5 students, and then they wanted a lot more students. Well, we couldn't take on placement a lot more students. They said, can you place 25 to 30? I said, no way. You know, there was no internet. There was nothing like that. And Sheffield firms would just say, why would you want us to take an American when we've got loads of Sheffielders that we can interview? I said, no, you can't interview these people. You can't see them. You could phone them. They wouldn't take it. So anyway, I flew back to the university in Rochester, New York, and said, you know, we've got a problem, I can't find you these placements. Well, we've got to have 30 people go to Sheffield. And I said, well, all I can think of doing, and let me tell you that their placement system was different to ours. Everything was based on a 10-week system. So I said, well, I could put a program on. I could run a course for you, and we could call it something like European Business or British Business. And they said, that sounds promising. Well, I saw, once again, my entrepreneurial instinct coming out. I mean, this was a private university. They paid phenomenal fees. Well, it seemed so at the time. I think we're catching them up now. But no, we'll still only be about half theirs next year. So we did this and we filled the whole programme. So I went and I took a nice fee out of it because after all, it was a privately run course. We paid for the rooms and everything. And this carried on. The first programme was in 1988, and we carried it on to 2002. So, you know, it ran for a long time. Now, this led to the next thing, because they all went piling into the Fat Cat. Well, where else am I going to take them on their first night? And they loved it. Well, the first group I brought over had a tutor with them just to make sure what things were like. And he walked into the Fat Cat on the Monday night, quiz night. Couldn't believe how busy it was. Mind you, it was really exceptionally busy that night. You couldn't get inside the front door. Mondays was always busy, but not that busy. And he just walked in and his beautiful American accent says, I love this place. And he said, have ever you thought of doing one of these in New York, in Rochester? We're partners, buddy. And I stuck my hand out and said, OK. Oh, there's my phone, sorry. I don't know where it is, so I'll just leave it. Sorry, I'm not. We decided to plan this bar. And I went through, we sat down the next day, went through a load of what we would call the principles that we'd run it on. And one was that every single thing in the building would come from England. The carpets, the curtains, all the furniture, all the wall mountings, the bar. And then I sort of shocked him because I'd got this idea and I'd had it in my brain for a while. I said, what about staff? And he says, oh, it's easy enough to get American staff. And I says, no, we don't really want English staff, do we? I don't want American staff. We want English staff. He said, well, you can't get English staff out here. I says, you can. You can take Hallam placement students. I said, you know, they've got a good school of hospitality. And he looked at me, he said, you can't just trust students to run a bar. Well, as I explained to him, if you go into a Chinese restaurant, you expect to see Chinese staff, same with an Indian, same with the Japanese. It's just natural. And I said, if people are going to walk in here, John, they are going to want to have English students. So I interviewed these poor people from here. I did feel a bit sorry for them. So I'm interviewing them for a job, for a bar that isn't yet open. And I said, do you want to go and open a bar and then run it? Well, they loved it. But I always remember one of them saying to me, who's our head chef? And I said, well, it's you. You're the team. You're running the whole show. I'm just throwing you in. You've got to go and buy all of the cutlery, all of the crockery, everything. I said, all that will be there is a fitted out bar. The bar will be there, the beer will be there, the spirits will be there. I said, all that will be there, all the furniture. But I said, there's no menu, nothing like that. You've got to do that. And they were half terrified. But I tell you, in terms of leadership, out of those 12 students that went, two or three of them immediately emerged. And I remember in the week before we opened, some of the food that they were turning out was absolutely magnificent. And they weren't fazed at all. They got them, wrote out menus and printed signs on the windows and on the door and put adverts in the local paper. They were absolutely phenomenal. We decided to call it the Old Toad. These guys did a great job. I had to then go and interview for another 12. And it's kept going just like that. And I interviewed for the last 12, just a few, I think it was about 3 or 4 weeks before Christmas. And I think there were 60 applicants for the 12 placements. It keeps going. It is just so successful. The Americans do think that our food is, believe it or not, excellent. They never quite understand what a Cornish pasty is or a steak and kidney pie. One or two dishes like this baffle them. Monday night is our, as they prefer the word, trivia night rather than quiz night. That you have to book your table by 7 or you don't get in. No prize, you don't win money. You just show that you're the cleverest person in Rochester. And my God, there's some clever sods out there. At least they think they are. But, I mean, it's really worked. And I tell you one thing, it would not have worked without the Sheffield Hallam students. They have done a phenomenal job. The current manager is a girl called Jules. She's 30. She did a placement. She was here. She did a placement year, I think it was 98, 99. She was staggering because she always said she was something strange. What do you call it? A goth. When she went out, she'd always got wings on. And she had this amazing coloured hair. And I tried to get her to change it without any luck. She says, I'll change anything, Dave, for you, but I'm not changing the colour of her hair. But I said, it's bright orange this week, George. Last week it was bright green. Well, one day she walked into my office when she's back in Sheffield. She's graduated from here. She walked in and her hair was normal colour. And I thought, something strange going on here. And she walked in. I just wondered if I could possibly have a word with you, Dave. You know, and I think, yeah, what's up? She says, I really desperately want to go back to work in the Old Toad again. Any particular reason, Jules? Well, yeah, I loved it out there. I said, beyond that, yeah, she'd got a fella. Anyway, she went out. She's managed it ever since. She's still there. She's got two beautiful children. And the assistant manager and the head chef are both ex-students of here who've done their placement year, come back, graduated, and then asked me if they can go back out. And I've got a feeling that there's one going back this coming summer. Yeah, he is, because he wants to. He's got a special interest in beer, and he wants to really develop our beer cellar. So that was a bit of a success. I'd say that's still going as well. So anyway, the other thing, and the final thing I was going to talk about was I was in my office. We used to have a horrible building then called Dyson House. Yes. And I was in this horrible building one day reading the paper, and it said the government have considered the report that I was, as I say, one of many, many people pushing for changes in the industry. They've read the report that came out of that, and the minister is minded to make the changes. Always remember the strange phrase he used. And he will allow a certain degree of competition, and he will let certain beers from non-home beers into Tidehouse pubs. So that means that a Stones pub, a Tetley's pub, a John Smith's pub could have a beer in it that wasn't theirs. And I thought, this is it, build a brewery. So I started to look that afternoon. Within about a month, I did everything in the wrong order. I bought brewing equipment, but I ain't got a brewery to put it in. Well, luckily, myself and another couple of guys, I was nothing to do with the music, the entertainment in any way, but I'd done the bars. We set up a club in Sheffield called the Lead Mill, and that had got plenty of space in it. So I managed to store this in the Lead Mill until about 6-7 months later we could move it because we'd managed to get a brewery built. And anyway, we opened up the brewery in September 1990. Now everyone again laughed. I mean, the one thing I've got used to now is that people, I expect them to sort of laugh and say, you really are doing the craziest thing imaginable. Because if they don't, I start to worry now. You know, is this going to be a success? I mean, the fact was, back in those days, the year 1990, there was a big brewery on Ecclesall Road, which you can see the remnants of, called Ward's. Yeah. A brewery that's still standing almost in its entirety, called Stone's. A brewery of which none is left, called Hope and Anchor, behind the Wednesday football ground. Mm. And there was the Whitbread Brewery, of which the frontage of that still stands. These were all very large breweries producing vast sums of beer. And my brewery was, if I'm stretching a point, it was about as big as a double garage. I think you could get two cars in it, but that's all. And everyone said, you know, this is quaint. Well, if somebody had told me in 1990 that in 1999 I'd be the biggest brewery in Sheffield, I would have said you were definitely mad. But that was the situation. All the other four breweries had closed. Just shows what happens if you make really good beer, who you can get rid of. No, there were all sorts of industry reasons, but here I was, the biggest brewery in Sheffield, with two of us and a dog sort of thing just running it, you know. And let me say that this was the same summer that I was doing the Old Toad, because they both opened in 1990. And believe it or not, I was still lecturing here. You know, so I handed him a notice then and went to concentrate on these two ventures. The brewery was an incredible success. I mean, it really was. Within about, I think it was 8 years, I was looking to buy land and built a new brewery, of which I managed to acquire it off the council. Quick business if you buy land off the council. Oof, dear, 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 that took a year. Anyway, we built it with all the changes in planning permission. I found, if you wanted to know some of the things about going into business and why, what I've learnt, one of them is you have battles ahead. You have people who are with you and people who are against you. And believe you me, most people in local authorities are quite definitely against you. They don't want to let you do this or that or the other. They run up costs. It is staggering. But anyway, we did get the new brewery open in 1999. I've been trying to get new premises ever since then. We've way outgrown these. What I did as a result of not being able to buy land where I wanted at Kelham Island, I bought land. I opened a brewery in Nottinghamshire, in the most staggering place I've ever seen in my life. I was asked by somebody, the story was, I was taking my equipment out of my brewery and putting in bigger equipment, whole 50% change. Every bit of equipment was coming out. This was about 18 months ago. And somebody phoned me up and said, I hear you're selling your brewing equipment. Terribly posh, you know. I said, yeah, that's perfectly true. How much do you want for it? I gave him a price. He agreed. now what do I do with this stuff? And I says, well, you need a brewery and you need a brewer. Oh, God, how do I do that? And I says, would you like me to do it for you? And he says, love to, old boy. Got a deal there. Do come out and see me. And that was it. The strangest of all the conversations I've ever had on the phone, this must have been one of the strangest. So I drive out to this place, which is called Welbeck Abbey. Well, I've known a little bit about English country houses. You know, you've seen Chatsworth.
Yeah.
You think Chatsworth is big? My God, you could fit Chatsworth into Welbeck's front garden. I pulled into their entrance, where they've got a garden centre and a farm shop and all these other whole range of shops and galleries. And I phoned up the guy who was at base in the middle of the estate, and he said, oh, I'll come straight over, I'm in my car. It will take me about 15 minutes. 15 minutes? How big is this place? Anyway, we were driving along, and you go past, you see what you think is the building. And he says, oh, this is the stables. It's got an acre of land inside so that the old dukes could exercise their horses. Really? Wow. Then you go past another big building and another one. Most of these would be bigger than other stately homes. I'd put a brewery in a stately home about 5 years before called Thornbridge, which was beautiful. But, I mean, you could put Thornbridge in any of these buildings. And eventually we reach not the house, but the area where the brewery is going to be. So anyway, I'm then told the story of in 1850, this estate, which had always been, it's called Welbeck, it's always been managed by the Dukes of Portland. And the fifth Duke of Portland had lost his marbles. And he decided that he didn't want anyone to ever see him. There's some funny people around, aren't there? So he built a whole labyrinth of tunnels built so that every building was joined to every other building. And he could drive with his elaborate coach and two horses side by side. See, it's about the size of an underground tunnel. Some of them are still there, because we're storing beer in some of them. And then to finish it off, he added a 3.5-mile tunnel to Worksop Railway Station. And he thought while he was doing it, he would add a dance hall underground, as you do. I mean, why not? If you're building tunnels, why not build a dance hall? This is still, to this day, Britain's biggest underground building of that type. It's amazing what people get up to. But anyway, we worked on this brewery, and unfortunately, I became ill in the meanwhile, but we got it open. We got it open in May of this year. It's doing incredibly well. I go out as regularly as I can, but the Welbeck Brewery is doing. And that was really, I only built that as an extension, I thought, to the Kelham Island, so I could brew all this extra beer that I can't make at Kelham. It hasn't worked out like that. And I mean, again, you see, if you just choose the right person. I put a 25-year-old girl in as a head brewer. If she did a year's, she had to do a year's experience. She'd got a very, very good microbiology degree from the University of Sheffield. Anyway, she's there managing that. She's phoning, problem after problem, can't produce enough, running out of cast, running out of this. Then my own brewer came up for a couple of hours yesterday. He's saying, we haven't got enough of this, we're running out of that. You know, it's... Well, they're nice problems to have.
Yeah.
I'd rather have those than somebody saying to me, don't know where we're going, Dave, with this recession. You know, every month so far in the recession, sales have gone up. So, apart from January, where in the drinks business, you know, you normally get a downturn. And so that's about it, all except that, you know, an ironic twist at the end of it all. The University of Sheffield called me up and they said, would you mind putting on an MSc in microbrewing for us? I said, you know, that sounds a pretty big task. But a bit like Steve when he was talking earlier, not one to say no. So I joined a committee and we wrote up this degree in the summer and we opened it in October. And one of the complaints that I'd got was that we hadn't got a brewery. So I said, we must get a brewery in the University of Sheffield. Well, they're never going to allow that. The professor I'm working with said, don't worry, I'll push it through. How much can you get some microbrewery for? All in. I said, the cheapest I can find is 2,750. He says, oh, we'll have one of those then. And it's in and it's running. If you know the beautiful building, well, it's called Firth Court. If you go in there, two flights of steps up to the right, first left, there's the University Brewery, which I put in. So, you know, it still keep my hand in. I lecture on it, and the strangest thing ever, and I say I've done some crazy things, but I did say to the students the last 2 weeks, this is the craziest thing I've ever done. I phoned the university at Christmas and said, you know, I've taken a turn for the worse. But the bad thing about it was I'd seriously damaged my shoulder. And I'd been in hospital. Damaging my shoulder meant that I couldn't get on my wheelchair. So I said, look, if I can't get on a wheelchair, I can't get down to the university to teach. Anyway, got back to within a week and the students said, we'd rather come and have you teach us at your house than us appoint another lecture. So I've actually had lectures, yeah, 2 weeks running in my bedroom as I lay in bed.
You are a madman.
And that is absolutely true. Absolutely true. So, tell you, not very big, I can assure you. But then you don't get many students on the first year of a, you know, master's course. But anyway, that's a different kind of a fat cat story. Well, is that okay?
Yeah. Thank you so much on behalf of everybody. That was absolutely brilliant. Thanks for giving up your time and coming to speak to us. Any questions?
Oh no, I try and keep them as similar as possible. It's great that, you know, people do. The odd person happens to be, you know, touring North America, and they say we're going to call in and see what the old toad's like. And we get some American customers come into the Fat Cat, and they comment on how similar they are. Yeah, I think that's the whole beauty of it. The American bar. For those of you that go to America, know that bars are usually very, very noisy. And the fact is there, ours is quiet, people just sit, drink and talk.
So do you have like the same menus on at the same time? No,
nothing like that, because I have to leave the students out there to be totally independent. So they cook whatever they like.
Can I just add that? It's not a question, it's a statement, because I've been to the Old Toad in Rochester.
Oh, have you?
And what Dave just said there is absolutely right. They run it. It was quite... pretty awesome, actually. Quite a change to see that. These guys, don't they? They run the operation. Very, very.
Is it like a similar size to the Fat Cat? I've been to the Fat Cat a few times.
Is it similar in what?
Similar size, like.
No, it's about twice as big. Yeah. Is that it?
No. Okay. Well, thank you once again, Dave. And once again, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Peter Spencer, who's going to talk to you about becoming an expert at anything. Over to you, Peter.
Thank you.
Technology.
Well, the first thing I should say is that talk about expertise is that my colleague Paul here, if it weren't for his expertise, I wouldn't actually have any presentation to give because the computer is, my one at home doesn't seem to be compatible. However, we'll begin. Definition of expertise, can you think on your feet? Let's see. So lots of the whizzy transitions I had on this have all gone OK, so we'll just have to wing it. Perhaps I should say how to become an expert, not anything you put your mind to. You can't become an expert at everything, as we'll see as we go through. So I kind of guess, simple definition to start with, what's an expert? So this is someone who obviously has a large amount of knowledge in, and this is important, in a very specific area of study. Nothing contentious about that, I guess. Or somebody equally well who's engaged in pursuing that in this prolonged or intensive experience of the subject. Okay. And has become an expert by. Now, this is pretty important. So these are the possibilities for becoming an expert. You can have qualifications. Credentials is a way of thinking about it. Of course, training, education, that's something that we're all involved in. It could be as part of your profession. It can be because, like Stephen, you've published extensively and you've read very widely. Or it can be through the process of experience. So this is about the nature of expertise, remember. This isn't about academic expertise as such. Of course, this is perhaps a really weird thing to say to university. Qualifications, credentials aren't necessary in order to become an expert at something. There is a societal consensus, an agreement really, that we know expertise when we see it. And it doesn't necessarily have to be because somebody's presenting you with a piece of paper that says, you know, this person is qualified to X, Y, and Z. So here's a good example of something. This is a wonderful country house in Norfolk and built in about 1475, I think. And there isn't a single person who worked on this house, nor the person who designed it, the person who did the stonework, cast the bricks, did the lead work, did the furniture inside. Not a single person has a qualification. And yet, there it is. It's still stood up 600 years later. That's one of the things I'm talking about. Equally well, take this magnificent-looking thing here. This is a railway train from the turn of the century. And, of course, this has nothing to do with this person stood on the left-hand side, who seems to be rather pleased with himself. Again, made by people without any qualifications. They'd not been to college, they'd not been to university. They probably left school at 12, most of them, or 14, perhaps, if they stayed on. And yet they've made something that's still alive and working right now. And perhaps finally, the person, the Flemish painter who painted this painting, again, had not got any qualifications in it. But I think you'll agree that all expert artefacts in their own right, that you don't have to have qualifications. So how about a recipe then, speaking as a chef, for expertise? Well, this is what some people would say. You need all of these things. Now, unfortunately, what happens is, this has gone off the screen now. It should have come down this sort of side of the screen, my wonderful whizzy wave, the other things have. But it seems to have disappeared into the computer. Anyway, this is what people think of. When you think of developing huge skill or expertise, something that people admire, they think, well, they must have been lucky in some kind of way. They've got some kind of innate ability. They were born with some kind of gift of some kind. They got it from their mum and dad. Dad was a fantastic person. The mum was wonderful at something. Or they've got a natural talent. And they think then, OK, maybe it takes a little bit of commitment, a bit of dedication, a little bit of hard work and that kind of thing. You might recognise some of these phrases. Some of these have been said to me over the years. That one doesn't apply to me, by the way. And people have said to me, well, I've demonstrated some sort of skill. Whoa, I wish I could do that. As though some had given it me. As though I hadn't kind of worked for ages and ages on it. And other things like this idea about somebody's got a natural ability, it's a God-given talent. There's a real snag with this, and this is something really that is, in all seriousness, I'd like to stress here. Expertise, wonderful skill, being fabulous, is absolutely got nothing to do with the gift. It's got comes from a completely different part of the psyche. Experts are, they create themselves. Experts are made, they're not born. Some people start off with a slightly better ability. For example, I'm a keen singer. My wife is a keen singer. She's actually got a better instrument than I have. She's got a better voice, but doesn't make her a better singer. Having a good voice and being a singer, not the same thing. The ability to actually read music, interpret stuff, Lynn's good, but, you know, she's got some advantage there, but it doesn't mean to say that that doesn't turn somebody into a wonderful guitar player, a fabulous musician, a wonderful chess player. This popular view that somehow we've got our talents from some sort of innate gift, that there's an inbuilt structure inside of us, is really destructive to the idea of what it means to be a human being. It decries and denigrates all of the fact that when we look at people and we admire their handiwork, like the painter or the person who built the building, that somehow we think, I don't know where it came from, they're lucky people, they had it from inside themselves. What we actually need is to believe in our own abilities, and we need the motivation to succeed. And if we have those things, we can certainly become an expert. I invite you to read that and have a think about it. It's a kind of a personal mantra from me, really. If we think that people have got special gifts or innate talents, if we believe that, we're cheating ourselves and others out of what they can actually really do, what we're really good at, not those other kinds of things. Here's a bit of it. It's inside of Peter's garage, that, actually, and that magnificent machine on the far left-hand side is the first motorcycle. I mention this because, obviously, a professional chef and educator, seems strange, but I do like getting oil under my fingernails. So this machine on this side here is the very first motorcycle I ever got when I was years old, 16, actually, and I've restored it. It was a bit of a mess. 16, it got crashed a lot. It used to be called Crasher Wheat Pete. Bit of a nice epithet there. This one here is a Triumph Bonneville, a new one, and that magnificent machine in the middle is a 1959 Velocet Venom, and that's just finishing off. I'm just finishing off restoring that. And I nicked some traffic lights that got knocked down, actually, by, you can probably see in the top left. And I thought, hey, they'd be good in the garage. Converted those with LED lights. Anyway, okay. I'm not pretending to be an expert in motorcycle re-engineering. Real expertise takes time. I've been interested in bikes since I can't remember, from a long time. And over that time, I've tried to acquire some expertise in it. But here's the key principle. Expertise takes time to acquire. How much time is a cracking good question. Now, this next bit, imagine it busting onto the screen with... Okay, it's just going to come on there. 10,000 hours is the short answer. To become seriously expert takes 10,000 hours. Okay, that's a kind of an interesting thing. I haven't made that up, by the way. This is a research that goes back as far as, I kind of guess, the late 1800s that have been developing over the time into expertise. But here's an idea. Let's try and give an idea of how much that is. Well, in a Victorian working week, 12-hour day, 6 days a week, you could expect to have put in, over the course of the year, 3,600 of those 10,000 hours. We don't work like that now, of course. That's great. 1950s working week. Things got a little bit better. 9 hours a day, 5.5 days a week. Work Saturday mornings, of course. 48 weeks of the year had us... fewer holidays, and that comes out of the 10,000, it's about 25%. That's that. A normal working week, that's now. I say normal, inverted commas, we'll see what odd academics do in a minute. Okay, normal working week, about 1,600, and an academic working week, which is not strictly fair on all my colleagues, but now I've left, I can go, yeah, okay. So you can see that's about 1,300 as opposed to 1,600 out of 10,000, okay? Here's somebody that will wipe the snigger off somebody's face. Hey, hey. Okay. Yeah, yeah. This is the top one is the best case scenario. Okay. So student working week, 5 hours a day, 5 days a week, 5 days a week. Hey. 600 hours. And the bottom one, the sort of SWOT we'd call the top one. I've met one or two SWOTs. One started off our presentation before, you know, is a great from... But anyway, and here, so more realistically, hey, I'm not in lectures today. I don't actually have to get in there. I'll go to the library and do some reading. Oh, the learning centre's open 24 hours a day. Get in there. No. Oh, yeah, all right. Anyway, so I don't think anybody's going to disagree with that, are they? So these are the years required to become an expert. It's gone off the bottom of the screen, but I'll read it to you, okay? So the Victorian person would have taken 2.5, just a little bit more than 2.5 years, person in the 1950s, 4, as you can see. Right now, it takes about 6 years to actually do it. An academic, 7 years. Now, unfortunately, the best bit's gone off. A good student, 16.7 years. And your average student, 26.5 years. Eh? I call that a serious university course, don't you? 26.5 years. OK, but that's a course. That's, you know, I'm being slightly facetious there. So let's take our normal case scenario. Somebody goes out to work, they work 5 days a week, they put in a normal gig, what, and they did get about, you know, every year they're accumulating 1,600 hours. In 6 years, they've done 10,000 hours. Is everybody you know, open question, rhetorical, is everybody you know has done 6 years experience an expert? Well, no, I don't think they are. I've met plenty of people who've come around to do some jobs on the house. I've been a plumber for 30 years. Oh, my God, look at the quality of that work. No, they're not always an expert. And the reason is because it requires something called deliberate practice. I'm going to talk to you about that. To become an expert at something requires something called deliberate practice. So let's have a look at that, expertise and deliberate practice. Some early studies right back in 1899 by people called Bryan and Harter, they were looking at emerging technology, and they were particularly interested in people who were learning to do Morse code or typing, the emergence of new technology. And they found it took about 10 years to become really seriously expert at it. In 1973, a group of people headed by a couple called Simon and Chase, they did some more work, and they also found out in chess and in music, it remained the same, about 10 years to become seriously expert in something. In actual fact, subsequent studies by Ericsson and others, who's the kind of national, the real world expert in it, have found that if you just simply look at the amount of time somebody spends, just time, it correlates really badly with expertise. So it's not just time, it's what you do with the time, perhaps not that surprising, that actually helps you to acquire expertise. So it's more complex than might first be imagined. So we can actually say, with confidence, because there's been loads of research done on it, there is an absolute relationship, an absolute correlation between deliberate practice, and I'll tell you about it in a second, and the attainment of expertise. You progress fastest if you do weekly practice, and the largest amount of weekly practice that people do, the faster and more quickly people progress onto expertise. But this point again, simply being there, simply actually putting in the time as such without configuring it into a sort of deliberate practice won't actually give you full kind of expertise. So what is it then? So here's a good working definition. Activities specifically designed to improve performance. Now actually that sounds simple, but honestly, my own research is, and I've did quite a lot of this when I did my own doctorate, researching this for other people. Quite a lot of people, when they're doing something, they're not doing it to analyse it and think about how they're going to get better. It's this idea that it needs to be effortful, not just being there. You have to focus on what you want to achieve. You've got to have a clear target, and you've got to do it again and again and again and again. So repetition is a function of expertise. Sounds prosaic, but it's completely true. Okay. This is really important. Expertise is what's called in educational jargon domain specific. That means to say it's not about education in general, it's not about mechanicking in general, it's not about sort of playing games in general, it's about something very specific. So if within the idea, for example, of educational endeavour, when I was doing my doctorate in education, I was focusing on the domain of skill acquisition and transmission. So that's where I gained my expertise. Not in generally, oh, look, I have a doctorate of education, I can tell you everything you need to know about education because I've got a doctorate in it. It's very focused. So here's some examples. So it's a domain specificity. It's like when you learn chess, it doesn't make you good at board games in general. I don't think anybody who plays chess is great at Scrabble, necessarily. They're focusing on chess. If you are studying surgery, it's with a focus. Cardiology, not just general surgery. You don't want a cardiologist to go, I'll just operate on your brain now. We'll whip that out. You'll be a lot better off for it, Peter. I'm sure I would. Sculpture, not art. Art is a very wide field, but it's sculpture's domain-specific. And cooking, I like to think of myself as an expert in cooking. And later on, of course, I've developed skills in hospitality. I think my expertise is in cooking, and actually specifically in classical French cooking. Cooking is such a wide canon of work now that you really, that domain specificity has to come down. So there's something about the nature of expertise which is highly focused. It's to be good at something. So here's the point of all of that. Experts become expert at something specific. There is no such thing as a generic view of expertise. Oh, you can talk to me, I'm an expert. What in, what have you got? Doesn't work like that, okay? Or even, you can talk to me generally about any aspect of hospitality, I'm okay. I mean, we'll make some exceptions about hospitality and so on. Obviously, are pretty good. Most great business people can give you a heck of a good steer on lots of business issues, but they're focused on issues which fundamentally relate to their own specific area. So this deliberate practice, DP, focuses on specific improvements. I'll give you an example. We think about driving a car, and we can see some people are expert rally drivers and that kind of thing. We think, well, that's wonderful. But, you know, this idea of deliberate practice is about car control. It's not just about driving. We learn to drive when we go out and we, you know, we want to pass our test. For example, in the same idea. The idea of learning to brake properly is, if you want to be, you know, have deliberate practice, you have to think about where you would brake. Not just, hey, I put my foot on the brake and the car comes to stop. If you're going to do it from a deliberate practice point of view, you have to understand something about the coefficient of friction between the tyres, acceleration, deceleration. Perhaps you have to understand something about what's called the parallelogram of forces, that a tyre will only grip for a certain length of time. Once it steps beyond that, you will skid. You have to know how hard to brake to make it stop in a racing situation, for example, without skidding the front tyre and then coming off the bike or having the car oversteer or whatever, that kind of thing. So it's about thinking about that, not that. When we're thinking about being an expert, we can actually supplement that with what are called domain-related activities. So that's typically people who are interested profoundly in something, maybe like music, would go along and listen to other people perform. They'd watch videos of other people's techniques. They don't just have to necessarily, if you want to play the guitar, I play the guitar, you don't have to. I'm always gobsmacked when I see a great technician and I think, how's that done? How's that fingering happening? Let me replay that again. I want to see it. So I may not be practicing on the guitar, but I'm looking at domain-related activities, watching, analysing what's going on, that kind of thing. So in other words, it's a kind of thinking about this deliberate practice, its involvement in the total activity, the specific activity, trying to get it round in total. Okay, practice. Practice makes perfect. No, it doesn't really. Practice makes better, certainly, and practice makes expertise. But quality practice means that when you're practicing, you're only practicing to improve your performance. And this applies just as much to writing as it does to painting or building or plumbing or anything else you care to name. It's or playing chess or playing music. It's about practicing to get better, to improve. It's not just about doing. Doing something is not practicing it. Doing something is doing it. Okay? So, for example, coming to university and studying on a particular kind of course and thinking, well, I always come, I always put the time in, I'm always there when I need to be. Being there, presenteeism, shall we say, is not practicing. Deliberate practice means always practicing to improve one's own abilities in something. It's not a small point. Most people, when they practice, they don't practice to improve. The other day, I saw Jenny Ennis being interviewed on television, and she was saying that she just actually won the indoor hurdles, and it's a key event for her Olympic bid. And she was saying that she'd been practicing the starts. So she'd been practicing for hours just on getting out of the blocks a handful of milliseconds earlier than the next person. Not running off down the track, doing, oh, I'm jumping the hurdles, I'm She knew what she was short of, and she was practicing on that, just to improve it. And of course, when you do that kind of thing, you repeat it, you measure, have I improved, and then you go on to try it again and again and again, and you're not satisfied just with saying, hey, I'm okay, I want to be an expert, I need to go beyond that particular point. So here's some implications for all of us, okay? In order to become an expert, we have to put the time in. And as you can see from this little list here, there are no shortcuts. You can't become an expert. Nobody can feed it into your brain. You've got to put the time in. It's a time-served occupation. So when you think some of those things I showed you, the painting, the building, those people served their apprenticeship between 5 and 7 years. They then went on to become what's called a journeyman. That is to say, they literally packed a bag and they left where they were being made an apprentice, and they journeyed off to find themselves in the workshop of another master craftsman, where they went on to now ply the skills. It's generally thought that journeyman activities took a further 8 years or so, and then they could consider themselves to be up to snuff. PhDs, doctorates generally, if you're giving it full beans, you're giving it, you know, real revving, you can probably get there in 4 years, five, more typically six or something. I wouldn't want any doctor to actually operate on me who hadn't gone through a serious amount of medical training. It's interesting that over the years in universities, I make a political point, we've cut down on the number of hours that we need to do various courses. Oh, we can do that in 16 hours a week. Let's add student self-study time on. And, you know, what's called, so notional hours, 160 hours to do this module. Taught hours, five. I exaggerate slightly. Taught hours, you know, 24 or something. I'm glad they don't do that in medical training. The other day, I was doing a presentation over at Culinary Institute in Switzerland, just outside Montreux, and I was talking to them about exams, and they'd been writing some multi-choice examinations, so they weren't doing very well. Not surprising, really. They're trying to deliver UK standards off a different kind of background. So I knew that medical multi-choice questions were pretty foxy, so I downloaded one from the net. It took me about 3/4 of an hour to copy it out onto my sort of computer screen in PowerPoint. And so I showed it to them. It had, this is just a multi-choice A, B, C, D, or E, but it had 5 different screens of information. A person presents to hospital, he's fallen over in the street, and he's had this kind of thing, he's got straw-coloured fluid coming out of one ear. Yeah. The following, he had an examination, so many millimoles of that, his blood pressure was this, his daddy, daddy, daddy. Turn over the page, glycemic test reveal, blah, 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 blah. Another page with all sorts of mumbo jumbo on, and then it went, which of the following kind of problems has he got? And everybody in the audience went, and I went, well, come on then, you've seen a question, or what's your kind of problem? But right, there's a difference between expertise and just knowing a few things. You know, souffle au fromage contains which of the following ingredients? Cheese, you know, kind of wine, I don't know, whatever. That's not so difficult to get A, B, C, D. The other ones are more difficult. So medical training is one of the things that's not been chopped down because we need genuine expertise. And, of course, if you want to succeed in business, you've got to, you know, you've got to work hard, you've got to make mistakes, usually at other people's expense, which is great if you can. And then when you go on to become an amazing CEO of an enormous company, you know everything. Or no. We like to think of you as knowing everything here. Okay, so what's this? So just being there won't do it. It just won't do it. Just actually turning up and doing it won't. You need consistent desire to improve. Time, then, nice philosophical term. Time is a necessary condition for expertise, but it's not a sufficient condition. That is to say, without time, you can't become expert, but you need other things. Enthusiasm, motivation. You need some talent. Actually, talent isn't an innate thing. Talent comes from the fact you probably started early. When people talk about Tiger Woods, I know his golf game has gone off through some unfortunate circumstances, but when you talk about him, he started playing golf at 6. Mozart started playing the piano, well, the clavichord, actually, at 3. By 5, you could turn him upside down and he could play the tune backwards. Quite amazing. Other people, Bobby Fischer was generally considered to be the finest chess champion. He's a complete nutcase, but the finest chess champion the world has ever seen. He did nothing but play chess from 6 years old. Now, he couldn't do anything else but play chess, which is why he went completely bonkers in the end. But nonetheless, so it's a necessary condition time, but you do need other things as well, as I've tried to point out. Important thing to realise it. I'm looking at everybody in the room. Everybody has what it takes to be an expert. Everybody. It's just not something, it's not an innate talent. And everyone has the wherewithal to become an expert. We carry the price about with us. In other words, it's in our own gift. It's not, we don't get lucky, we don't get, you don't get, you might get famous if you go on Big Brother, that's for now, isn't it? But anyway, we carry the price of it around with us, as it were. It's within our own gift to do it. So, what is the path to experience then? Okay, it doesn't simply do 10,000 hours. It's generally thought that 3,000 hours of focused, deliberate practice, not just being there, will make you into what's called a gifted amateur. Think of it this way. Somebody says, you go into a wonderful country house, they've got a grand piano, you've studied for 3,000 hours playing the piano, they say, could you play us something? You sit down there and everybody goes, clang, wow, you're good enough to go on the stage. You know you're not, but that's a gifted amateur. 5,000 hours, you could generally think that you could probably go along and accompany a choir because you can improvise and that kind of thing. At 10,000 hours, you could certainly think, as a pianist, even as an amateur, that you're capable of performing with, you know, really good quality orchestras. And at 30,000 hours, which is an enormous number of hours, then you are a genuine concert pianist that people will pay large amounts of money for to travel around the world and listen to. Now, interestingly enough, this one is generally thought to be, the 3,000 hours is thought to be round about 3 years of focused effort. It's a good rule of thumb, really, about 10 years. It doesn't take 30 years to become a world expert, because by the time you start to come up to 10 and 30,000 hours, the only thing you've got on your mind is becoming better and better at the one thing. So typically, people who are world experts spend 15 hours a day on their particular subject. But we don't, it'd be great if everyone in the room was a world expert, we don't need to aspire to that. What we can do is we can aspire to be expert, and you can see it comes in several flavours, right up to the top. So, here's the message. Everybody can be an expert. Everybody actually should be an expert. Why not? Why we leave it to somebody else? You can all become an expert at something you really appreciate. We've all got the same amount of time. Everybody's got 24/7. Like, oh, I'm very busy. It's terrible. I've got all these other things to do. Okay, I see. So your day is only 12 hours long. No, everybody works hard. When I was doing my own doctoral studies, I held down a job here at the university full-time and did other things. If you want a job doing this, give it a busy person. You can cram it in. And given the fact that the rest of your life starts today, if you want to be an expert, now's a great time to start. Hey, not like Peter Kay says, I'll start on Monday. You could start today, couldn't you, really? Rise to the top. That burst into flames, by the way, that become an expert. It was fabulous. But become an expert. That's how to do it. Thanks very much indeed.
Anybody like to ask a question?
Very interesting, Peter. Just, I was just wondering, because there's no mention there about age of commencing something.
Yep.
Just thinking about language, for example.
Right.
That having worked in some other countries, that you can see people who are experts at language,
yep,
who have maybe started early and had an opportunity to, whereas as an adult, then going to start and you've got the full effort, you're putting in the hours,
yep,
and all of that.
Yep.
But
no, it's a good question, John, and I think it's one that's frequently asked. It reminds me of the story of the motivational psychologist who's saying to the chap who's 40 years old, and the chap saying, said, "Well, how do you need to progress?" He said, "Well," he said, "I know I need to do the following couple of degrees." He said, "But it's going to take me 10 years," and he said, "I'll be 50 by then." Said, "Oh, yeah," he said, "You're right." He said, "How old will you be in 10 years if you don't do it?" He said, 50. He said, "Bloody hell, how come they're the same thing?" Yeah, so there's You see what I mean? So everybody can start. I think the only time you can't become an expert is when somebody goes, it's you, and they pop your clogs. You know what I mean? Up until that time. But there's an interesting point about linguistics and writing. Of all the things I've said, there's one exception to it. I didn't want to muddy the waters, but there's one exception. The only thing that it's generally accepted through research that people don't become fully expert at, in fact, is writing. It's the use of linguistics because it seems to be an extensible kind of arena. So even the most famous writers in the world just don't think they're good enough and always want to try, just want to try and get better. They really don't think that they've cracked it. So there is something about linguistics. But in all other areas of work, I think, and that's still no reason not to do it, is it? I mean, you can become fabulous at it, you know, Terry Pratchett or whomever else when it comes to writing, or even, you know, a famous professor. You don't have to worry about that kind of thing.
Stephen, can I go back to your presentation and ask you a question? You did your first degree in geography, you were saying, so catering and hospitality wasn't a career of first choice to you.
No, it wasn't.
So what made you change your mind and come into this industry as distinct from what you intended to do?
What I wanted to do at that time, actually, I wanted to go into retail management, because I'd done quite a lot of work in Marks and Spencers and in other independent operations. And I applied for a number of things. I applied, you know, we talk about applying for positions now, but in those days, I think the tendency was to apply for a lot of positions. And I applied on two rounds for over 100 positions. Mm. Many times I never heard anything. Mm. Many times the employers didn't reply to me. And probably like some of you, you got really angry about that. Some positions I was offered, but I just didn't like the offer. And so up my sleeve, I had an offer of a place at Manchester Met to do hospitality, hotel and catering, which I had some experience in. And I took the brave decision to do that, to go on to do further study. And that's what led me into hospitality management. So I could have gone other ways, I guess, but yeah. It was just one of those pivotal moments.
So often in this industry, it's a career of second choice because you're not doing very well in what you chose the first time. You haven't got significant qualifications to do it, which is one of the things that this industry suffers from.
Definitely.
Yeah, and also, it suffers from people stepping out of it too for some kind of reason, doesn't it? Lots of people who've actually taken extensive qualifications in it and then try it for a little bit and don't feel valued or don't feel that, you know, they can, you know, rise to the top that easily, and the consequence of which is that they decide to do something else.
I think it was interesting with the presentation first thing this morning, talking about long hours, etc. Yeah. If you listen to Raymond Blanc on Monday and his lifetime achievement thing, saying that, you know, we've got to get away from being an industry of long hours.
It's true, isn't it? Because, I mean, take somebody like Raymond Blanc, fantastic, isn't he? But, you know, I mean, he's sacrificed his marriage, his life, everything to the one object. And you have to say that, just, you know, you can become an expert in something. It doesn't mean to say you have to become a Bobby Fischer. You don't have to become that focused on something that you have nothing else in your life whatsoever. I think sometimes the hospitality industry does demand too much from people. I agree with you.